In the World Service of the BBC, this is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Today, the end of an era as Pol Pot's last lieutenants defect to the Cambodian government. 16 kidnapped foreign nationals in Yemen wait to hear their fate. We talk live to the British ambassador there. And Cyprus gets ready for the decision on its controversial missile deployment.
The international community sides with Turkey, sides with the party who have invaded Cyprus.
Also today, Beijing gets rid of the yellow bug taxis, and the British government comes in for some stick over its attitude towards child prostitution.
It's a bit hypocritical to say, yes, we treat them as victims, but no, we don't feel they shouldn't be liable to prosecution as common prostitutes.
The news today is read by Jackie Leonard.
Two leading associates of the late Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot have apologized for the genocide in Cambodia, in which more than 1 million people were killed in the 1970s. The two, Khieu Samphan and Nguyen Chia, defected to the government side last week. The Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen has made it clear that he opposes international calls for them to be tried for genocide. From the Cambodian capital Phnom Penh, here's Caroline Gluck.
The two architects of Cambodia's killing fields told journalists that they were sorry for what had happened in the past, but neither of them wanted to talk about their role in the Khmer Rouge's reign of terror in the late 1970s, during which more than 1 million people were killed, preferring instead to talk about the need to move forward. Khieu Samphan, who for many years was the public face of the secretive Khmer Rouge, said that bygones should be bygones, that international pressure for any war crimes tribunal was not the best solution. Let Cambodians solve their problems themselves, he urged. He acknowledged that many Cambodians were resentful at leaders of the guerrilla movement since their family members had lost their lives, but appealed to them to look forward and not back at the past.
Medical evidence at the trial of the former Malaysian Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has contradicted prosecution allegations that he'd recently had intimate sexual relations with his adopted brother, Sukma Darmawan. Mr. Anwar is facing charges of corruption and sexual misconduct. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Simon Ingram reports.
The explicit, often sordid details exposed before the Kuala Lumpur High Court since Anwar Ibrahim's trial began in early November have shocked a largely conservative nation. The latest witness to take the stand is a government doctor, Zahari Noor, who was questioned by defense counsel about a medical examination he conducted on Sukma Darmawan, one of two men jailed in September for allowing himself to be sodomized by the former deputy prime minister. Dr. Zahari said that he'd found no physical evidence that Mr. Sukma had engaged in anal intercourse. Mr. Sukma, like the man convicted with him on a similar charge, Munawar Anis, has appealed against his sentence, saying police coerced him into making a false confession. Dr. Zahari's testimony is a welcome boost to Mr. Anwar's lawyers, who are trying to prove that he's been framed in an attempt to ruin his political career.
There's speculation that the Greek Cypriots are about to back down from plans to deploy Russian anti-aircraft missiles before the end of the year. Turkey, which supports the breakaway Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, has threatened military action if the missiles are installed. The Cypriot president, Glaklos Karidis, is returning from talks in Greece for a meeting today of his top advisory council, where his spokesman says the final decision will be made. The blood transfusion service in South Africa is appealing for blood donors to help cope with a huge number of traffic accidents. More than 600 people have been killed so far this month. From Johannesburg, Jane Stanley reports.
South Africa's blood transfusion service says it's operating on a day-to-day basis and urgently needs at least 6,000 litres of blood. Many regular donors have gone home to rural areas or to the coast for the holiday season. But the real problem is the huge number of accidents on South Africa's roads. 600 people have been killed since the holiday period began at the start of December. Hundreds more have been injured. Drunken and reckless driving are to blame. Last year, by the time the season was over, more than 1,000 South Africans had lost their lives. 6,000 others had been injured. This year, the government has been running a special Arrive Alive campaign to highlight the lethal combination of speed and alcohol. Extra police officers with state-of-the-art breathalyzers and radar speed detectors have also been deployed.
The authorities in Yemen have been briefing British officials on the progress of efforts to secure the release of 16 Western tourists kidnapped yesterday by armed tribesmen. 12 of the captives are Britons. There are also two Americans and two Australians. Their vehicles were stopped at gunpoint in a remote region in the south, but five of them, including a British tour guide, escaped. The Yemenis say the others are safe and well, but it's not yet clear what the kidnappers are demanding. It's emerged that the Russian central bank is being investigated over $1 billion reported to be missing from national funds. The Interior Minister, Sergei Stepashin, told the Russian news agency Interfax that the investigation began after the devaluation of the ruble a few months ago. He said police, the Federal Security Service, and the Prosecutor General were involved in examining central bank activities since 1992. A ministry official said the missing money would help explain the ruble crisis. BBC World Service.
There was an extraordinary scene in the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, today as two senior figures from the Khmer Rouge were entertained to lunch by the Prime Minister Hun Sen. The two, Khieu Samphan and Nuon Chea, were part of Pol Pot's murderous regime in the 1970s. They held senior positions while more than a million people died in the killing fields as Cambodia was taken back to year zero. And they'd remained loyal to the Khmer Rouge during the past two decades of civil war. Until now, that is. Now Pol Pot is dead, and even his most senior lieutenants have defected to the government. But it seems there's to be no trial to make these men account for their actions. Khieu Samphan spoke to reporters in Phnom Penh.
Let bygone be bygone. The best solution for our country, because it's the only way to reach national reconciliation.
The former Khmer Rouge leader Khieu Samphan speaking to reporters in Phnom Penh a short time ago. On the line now is the Cambodia specialist with the Far East Economic Review, Nate Thayer. Nate, how much disquiet will there be that it appears that there will be no prosecution of these men for what they did in the Pol Pot years?
Well, I think actually relatively little. This is really the final process of reintegration of the former Khmer Rouge, including their very top leadership, into national society, into a government, a current government, which is controlled by former Khmer Rouge. We must remember virtually the entire leadership of the current government, recognized by London and Washington and most of the Western democracies, are in fact run by Khmer Rouge officials who were in control during the so-called killing fields. That includes the Prime Minister, the Defense Minister, the Foreign Minister, on and on and on, literally thousands of officials right down to the village level.
So at sort of senior level, they are all known to each other, Hun Sen, Khieu Samphan, all that lot. They come from similar molds. But does that also translate to the attitude of those in the street in Phnom Penh, for example? Will they be happy to see these people returning to the fold in this way?
You know, that is really it's a very good question, and the answer is that almost all Cambodians, from noodle vendors on up, are of two minds. They have a choice, really, a choice of national reconciliation, of opening old wounds, of terrible, unspeakable atrocities which occurred on more than two decades ago, seeking justice for those crimes, or letting, as Khieu Samphan said, bygones be bygones, and trying to rebuild a country which is essentially shattered, a country in ashes. And you really cannot have both. While most Cambodians would like to, most would actually choose national reconciliation and to not open up the old wounds, which would tear apart the very fabric of the mainstream political parties in Cambodia today, which are essentially made up of former Khmer Rouge.
And this is a debate that ordinary Cambodians have been allowed to take part in and have had some input in, is it?
Well, ordinary Cambodians aren't really allowed to have input in any real debate. This is a dictatorship. It continues to be. It's one of the worst human rights violators in Asia, certainly. It's not really a question that ordinary Cambodians are allowed to choose. But if you ask people on the streets, of course they're angry. Almost everybody lost immediate family members and so on and so forth to the Khmer Rouge. But they also, almost to a person, will say it's time to try to rebuild the country, and we can't do both. Tearing apart the country would be part of the consequences of bringing to justice those of which created such terrible suffering among millions so long ago.
Nate Thayer of the Far Eastern Economic Review, thanks for joining us. Now, today is likely to see an important decision from the Greek Cypriots, and it's a decision which could inflame passions on the divided Mediterranean island. The authorities in Nicosia have to rule on whether or not to deploy a new Russian anti-aircraft missile system. The Turks, who support the breakaway Turkish Cypriots in the north of the island, have said the deployment could provoke a military response. The Greek Cypriot leader, Glafkos Kleridis, will chair an emergency meeting of the National Council this afternoon. And there's every indication that following heavy international pressure, the deployment will be abandoned. Marios Matsakis is a leading Greek Cypriot MP with the centre-right opposition Diko Party in Nicosia.
Well, the position of my party and of the great majority of the Cypriot people is that these missiles would come to Cyprus. But, of course, we all understand now differently, and we feel that the decision will be that the missiles will not come to Cyprus.
But if that is the decision, and it is a compromise which is reached with the aim of achieving peace and helping to move any prospect of negotiations forward, that surely is a price worth paying.
Well, I would view it from a different point of view. I think that the perspective of peace and justice being done is going to be further than ever with this development, because the message will be given clear and loud to Turkey that they can do whatever they like now. The message will be that Cyprus is completely and utterly defenseless.
Well, that's not strictly the case, is it? Because if the compromise deal is as expected, in other words, that the missiles will be deployed on the island of Crete, that would give the Greek Air Force, which has a military defense alliance with Cyprus, it would give the Greek Air Force the cover it needed to defend Cyprus.
No, it won't, because Crete is about 500 nautical miles away from Cyprus, and the missiles can only reach about 70 miles away. So there will be no air cover over Cyprus, and the Greek Air Force will not be able to come to Cyprus and provide valuable air cover. And you see, the missiles is not the real matter, is not the number of missiles, which is a tiny number. The main issue here is the political matter of the fact that Cyprus can no longer make decisions which are about its own defense.
But you could also argue that Cyprus is making a very mature decision in the context of the international situation, and the alternative is surely worse. If these missiles are deployed, Turkey has threatened military action.
No, Turkey has not actually threatened military action directly. Turkey has said that if there are hostilities, they will be able to deal with these missiles. It's not a military matter, it's a political matter. And the fact is that with this decision not to deploy the missiles in Cyprus, and with the fact that it seems that the international community sides with Turkey, sides with the party who have invaded Cyprus, sides with the party who have violated the human rights in Cyprus and in Turkey itself, it seems that we are extremely disappointed now as Cypriots, because we feel there is no international justice anymore in this world. Absolutely none. We're let alone in this world to deal with a big bully called Turkey.
The Greek Cypriot MP, Marios Matsakis, from the centre-right opposition Diko Party, speaking from Nicosia. That's nearly 13:15 GMT. In a moment, we travel to northern Nigeria to explore the lingering regional tensions as Africa's most populous nation gets ready for democracy. And will the people of Beijing mourn the passing of the yellow bug taxis? You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Reminder of the headlines today. Two Khmer Rouge leaders who helped plot the deaths of more than a million Cambodians have said they're sorry for what happened. And some news just in. Government officials in Yemen say that a gun battle has taken place between security forces and the kidnappers of 16 Western tourists in the south of the country. They say that three of the hostages were among those killed in the battle, two Britons and one American. Details of that story are still coming in. We hope to be hearing live from Yemen later in the program. The British government has introduced new guidelines for the police and local authorities in dealing with child prostitution. There's been growing concern about a steady rise in the incidence of prostitution involving boys and girls under the age of 16. The junior health minister, Paul Boateng, has said that the new approach must be to target the pimps and abusers and to treat the child prostitutes themselves as victims. However, he's stopped short of decriminalising the activities of underage prostitutes.
This is a child-centered approach, but it is one also that recognizes that the best way to protect children is to deny to pimps and users any oxygen at all, and therefore to actually put out the message which would enable the pimps to say to children, it's okay, it's legal, love. This is what we can give you if you go on the game, would be entirely wrong. The message to pimps and abusers is that we're on your case, you're not going to get away with it.
The British Junior Health Minister, Paul Boateng. Not everyone is completely happy with the new approach. I've been speaking to Liz Atkins, Head of Public Policy with the British National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. I asked her first about the scale of the problem in Britain.
It's very difficult to say. A few hundred children each year are prosecuted or cautioned for soliciting or loitering. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are a lot of children who aren't on the street, who are actually shut away in rooms and used for sex. It's very difficult to say how big the problem is.
And this is not just child abuse, this is child prostitution. You're talking
child
about used for sex for money.
That's right. When children are lured into prostitution, then they're used for sex by adults, and pimps organise and profit from those activities.
What then, how would you characterise the shift in emphasis in these new government guidelines? What is the main thrust?
We very much welcome the guidelines, because what they're doing is saying to the police they should treat child prostitutes as victims rather than as offenders. And that is really important, because child prostitutes are abused children, and at the moment they're the only abused children who are treated as criminals rather than as victims.
And yet the government is not going down the path of decriminalising child prostitution, which would be, I would have thought, the logical conclusion of treating the child prostitutes as the victim.
Very much so, and that's why we regret the fact they're not going to take children out of the scope of the Street Offences Act. We feel that children should be treated as victims, and therefore it's a bit hypocritical to say, yes, we treat them as victims, but no, we don't feel they shouldn't be liable to prosecution as common prostitutes.
But there is that argument put forward by the Minister, Mr. Boateng, there, that if you were to decriminalise child prostitution, the pimps would be able to say to their victims, as they lure them into the trade, it's all right, it's legal.
Children never voluntarily go into prostitution. They're lured, coerced or enticed into it. We think the focus of any criminal investigation should be on those adults who abuse children. The adults who lure children into prostitution, the adults who use them, and the adults who profit from them.
Is the change in emphasis going to have an impact? It is, after all, only apparently a change in emphasis, not much of a change in the law.
No, that's right. I think the change of the emphasis will be very important, in that it will make sure that the police treat children as people who should be looked after rather than people who should be prosecuted, and that's very important. It's the welfare of the child that must be the main focus.
And are there lessons to be learned from the British experience elsewhere in the world where child prostitution is known to be perhaps a more serious issue?
I think there are lessons to be drawn, and so we're very pleased the government is working with Asian countries in their Asia and Europe initiative to ensure that child sex abuse is reduced, both in the UK and in other countries. I think we can learn from what's happening in places like the Philippines, and we're very pleased that the UK police are working very closely with their Philippines counterparts.
Liz Atkins of the British National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Nigeria is on the threshold of a new beginning. All being well, state elections next month will be followed by national elections in February, and the military government of General Abdulsalami Abubakar should hand over power to a civilian president in May. But Nigeria's latest attempt to introduce democratic government is being plagued by old problems. The regional and ethnic tensions between north and south have led to the southerners demanding that the next president should be from the south. Barnaby Phillips travelled north to Kano to find out what they think of the idea there.
This song, blaring out from loudspeakers on top of a van, urges passers-by on the streets of Kano to vote for the People's Democratic Party, or PDP. The PDP is very much the dominant political force here. Whereas in Lagos and the southwest of Nigeria, its support is limited, in the north it enjoys a clear ascendancy. If it can hold together, it ought to emerge as Nigeria's next ruling party. So it's not surprising that PDP activists like Garaba Ali challenge the legitimacy of a power shift to the south.
In the democratical elected country, or in a democratical practicing, there's nothing like power shift. It's people have to come out and contest, and everybody to see who will win the election. But power shift is not a democratic system in any country.
The problem is that the South, and in particular the Yoruba people of the Southwest, feel sorely aggrieved. The Yorubas believe, with good evidence, that their man, Moshood Abiola, would have won the 1993 elections if the military had not stepped in to cancel the results. Now, after years of dictatorial rule by the northern general, Sani Abacha, the South says that it is their turn to hold power. This argument is accepted by some in the North. Sulemano Kumo, a Kano-based lawyer, is one of the founders of the PDP.
After so many years of military rule and misrule, and after, you know, so many claims and so many things being said about northern domination, etc., and above all, after what Abacha have done, I don't think anybody from the north really would be able to justify wanting to try again. You see, the north had opportunities, and I think it is better so that, you know, for the purpose of reconciliation and the purposes of letting the people in the south have a go.
In the main hall of the Sani Abacha Youth Centre, a group of musicians play traditional Hausa instruments. But this youth centre, with its lavish facilities, stands out a mile amidst the general poverty and decay of Kano. The truth is that General Abacha may have called this city home, but he did little for its people. With most of them struggling to make ends meet, talk of northern domination seems absurd. And to local politicians like Garaba Ali, it invokes feelings of hostility towards the southerners who speak in those terms.
You see, they control the media. So what else? They control the administration. In every sector of the economy, they dominate it.
Kano-based journalist Jamila Tangaza says that southerners have to learn to distinguish between the north as a whole and the group of soldiers who have ruled the country for the past 15 years.
From the perspective of the people from the southern part of Nigeria, they think that the military clique or the military regimes are actually synonymous with the northern part of the country. The conflict, from my perspective, is between the military and the rest of Nigerians.
The cultural, religious and linguistic differences between north and south are strong, and the years of economic decline and repressive military rule have only exacerbated them. With presidential elections now only a matter of weeks away, Nigeria's political parties are still divided on the question of power shift. The challenge of finding a candidate acceptable to the whole country is as difficult as ever.
Barnaby Phillips reporting. Now, the normal street scene in Beijing is about to change as of today. The Chinese authorities have begun scrapping the capital's fleet of minibus taxis, melting down the first 3,000 of them at a local steelworks. The aim is to reduce exhaust fumes in what is one of the world's most polluted cities. The taxis make up fewer than 2% of Beijing's traffic, but officials say they produce 15% of the exhaust pollution. The plan is to remove all 20,000 minibus taxis from the capital's streets by the year 2000. Our correspondent in Beijing is Carrie Gracie.
They've been traditionally hugely important. When the economic revolution in China began in the early 80s, there really wasn't a taxi industry at all, and everybody traveled either by bicycle or by public bus. But as disposable incomes rose and people began to take a more individualistic approach to life generally, the taxi became very, very popular, and particularly these, because they were so cheap. They were 10 kuai or 10 yuan, which is little more than a dollar, to go pretty much anywhere in Beijing. And they were very small and with a tiny engine, but big enough to put several people in, and plus all your shopping, and plus, because they had a sliding door and not much seating inside, you could put in bulk items like washing machines or televisions, which, of course, in terms of everyone having increasing disposable incomes and therefore more money to spend and more things to buy, was very useful.
Do we know how many people were carried by these little yellow taxis each day or each week or what?
Well, officials estimate that 1.5 million taxi journeys are made in Beijing every day. And the little yellow bugs or miandi were taking up probably, I'd say, about two-thirds of that.
The people who've been using these little yellow taxis are going to be somewhat annoyed to have them removed, aren't they?
Well, I think the response is mixed, and it's perhaps not as vociferous as it would have been a couple of years ago for several reasons. The first is that I think most Beijingers now perceive that there really is a lot of environmental damage going on in this city due to economic development, and that the Miandi are a big part of that bad news story. The Miandi were allegedly responsible for 15% of all exhaust fume pollution here, and providing only 1.5% of all the cars on the road. And so they were doing their fair share in terms of polluting. And at the same time, the government has forced the other taxis in the market to bring their prices down. And there is also, because of the economic slowdown generally in China and in Asia, there is a glut of taxis around. So that taxi prices are coming down generally, and meanwhile the environmental damage of the Miandi is more evident. So I think Beijingers are doing all right, really. They see taxis still on the roads at an affordable price, and meanwhile they can see the Miandis that were causing all the damage going away. So there isn't really too much of a backlash in response to this.
Carrie Gracie in Beijing. And we'll stay in China for the business news now, where the authorities have finally passed legislation to govern their stock markets. With the details on that and the rest of the business news for today, here's Sumant Bhatia.
Well, yes, it's been 6 years in the making, but finally it's actually come. Stock markets in China have been rocked by repeated crises due to overspeculation, erratic prices, illegal trading, and even fraudulent information given to investors. These new laws will, above other things, improve financial data on companies and stop risky trading by banks and state industries. Peter Churchhouse of ABN AMRO in Hong Kong says it's good news for the 40 million Chinese who dabble in the markets.
The Chinese market trades on valuations or earnings multiples which are way, way, way higher than we see in anywhere else in the region. Really, the big issue here in China is that there are very few avenues for people to invest. There are no real pension funds or mutual funds or any of those sorts of things that people in the West have. So really, it's just a great big casino, and there just aren't many opportunities. So the stock market can be extremely speculative.
So though people are saying that actually there is a great need for more foreign investment in China, these regulations actually won't encourage that, will it? Will they?
Well, not directly, but I think indirectly, yes, because better transparency, better information flow, better regulation of both the brokerages and the companies themselves in terms of accounting standards, adherence to legal contracts and so on, in the end feeds through to a better market and a more transparent market for foreigners to invest in as well. So I think it will have benefits, but it's not as immediate, I think, as perhaps for the local investors.
Peter Churchhouse speaking to Sally Hardcastle. Well, turning now to the currency markets, and the dollar's worth 1 German mark, 67.4, and 115.1 Japanese yen, and the pound's at $1.67.8. On to the financial markets, London's 100 share index is currently 75 higher at 59.42, and the LSE has just announced that this year was a record year for the number of shares trading on its exchange. And earlier, Tokyo's Nikkei index was 137 higher at 13,846. And that's the business news.
Thank you, Sumant. Now, a couple of comments from our email file. Pierre Dargen from Belgium wants us to give more emphasis to the legal basis or otherwise behind the latest American military activity in Iraq. And Mr. Rajan Kumar from Norway wants us to put the Hindu point of view more clearly when addressing the whole question of attacks on Christians in India. Both points of view, I'm sure, we will take on board. The address for your comments, newshour@bbc.co.uk. Do write with your points of view if you can. Coming up in the next half hour, live from Yemen, we'll be trying to unravel what's happened after an operation to free kidnapped foreign hostages, an operation which seems to have resulted in the deaths of three of the hostages. And as a momentous year in the history of Northern Ireland draws to a close, we report on the lingering tensions between Protestant and Catholic. You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Right now, we'll get a summary of the latest world news from Jackie Leonard.
There's been a violent end to the kidnapping yesterday of 16 tourists in Yemen. Three of them, two Britons and an American, are reported to have been killed after security forces attacked the kidnappers. Some of the kidnappers were also killed. Two leading members of the former Khmer Rouge in Cambodia have apologized for the genocide in which up to 2 million people were killed. Khieu Samphan and Nguyen Chia, who defected last week, expressed regret but appealed for the past to be forgotten. Medical evidence at the trial of the former Malaysian Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has contradicted prosecution allegations that he'd recently had intimate sexual relations with his adopted brother. Mr. Anwar is facing charges of corruption and sexual misconduct. The blood transfusion service in South Africa is appealing for blood donors to help cope with a huge number of traffic accidents. More than 600 people have been killed so far this month in accidents blamed on drunken and reckless driving during the holiday season. The United States has joined several West African countries in accusing Liberia of backing rebel forces in neighboring Sierra Leone. A State Department spokesman said the United States stood firmly with the democratically elected government of President Tijani Kaba and could not countenance any renewed attempt to overthrow it by force. The government of the Basque region in Spain is holding its first meeting since elections last October gave power to a pro-independence coalition. A new Basque president is being chosen who will lead moves to consolidate the ceasefire declared by the separatist group ETA last September. The Chinese authorities have begun scrapping Beijing's fleet of minibus taxis, melting down the first 3,000. The aim is to reduce exhaust fumes in what is one of the world's most polluted capitals. Officials say they produce 15% of Beijing's exhaust pollution. BBC World Service.
Now, government officials in Yemen say there's been a bloody end to the kidnapping of 16 foreign tourists in Yemen. Three of them, two Britons and an American, are reported to have been killed after security forces attacked the kidnappers. The tourists were kidnapped yesterday while on a guided tour of mountain areas and archaeological sites. Details of the attempt to free them are still coming in. We hope to be hearing live from Yemen in a short moment. But first, we're joined on the line now by Carolyn Mitchell, who was herself kidnapped in April of this year in Yemen, along with her husband and teenaged son. Carolyn Mitchell, I guess we don't know what's happened today, but you were freed without the authorities resorting to violence.
Yes, we were. In fact, our kidnappers asked us to write and ask the authorities not to use force. They were quite adamant about that.
And what were your kidnappers demanding from the authorities?
They were demanding what they considered to be their fair share of monies that were coming into the country. Things like they wanted roads, hospitals, education, telephone lines, the basics of life that people in the cities take for granted, I think.
So it was social stroke economic demands rather than overtly political demands?
Yes, Yes, that was it.
But nevertheless, these people, given the nature of the country, would have been heavily armed. Did you feel that you were at any time under threat?
We didn't feel under threat, sort of personally from our kidnappers. But there was one time when we did hear mortar fire, and there's a lot of agitation amongst those we were with at the time, and we were actually moved three times and told it was for our own safety.
And did you get the impression from your kidnappers that if attacked, they would fight to hold on to you and to defend themselves?
I think they would have done, yes. They had the equipment to do it.
Meanwhile, whilst you were being held, how were you treated?
We were treated very well. We were basically treated as the guests of the family we were with.
And this is a traditional way of dealing with these things in Yemen. So I guess whilst you were being held, you would not have wanted yourselves, the authorities, to have launched any sort of rescue operation.
No, we were of that opinion as well, not only for our own safety, but also for the safety of the people we were with. I mean, we were with families with children, and didn't feel that it was right for them to be involved in such a thing.
Carolyn Mitchell, who was held for 17 days by kidnappers in Yemen in April of this year. Thanks very much for joining us. On the line now is our correspondent in the region, Frank Gardner. Frank, do we know what appears to have happened yet?
Well, what we know for certain is that there has been a shootout, and this is a pretty dramatic turn of events. It's incredibly confusing. The one source, namely Reuters, are saying that three of the Western hostages have been killed in a shootout which took place on Tuesday. However, I'm hearing from diplomatic sources that those three were wounded, not killed. There's still no official confirmation. Now, the remaining hostages are reported to have been released unharmed, and two of the kidnappers have been killed and the rest arrested.
So just to confirm, you're hearing conflicting reports as to whether or not any of the hostages have in fact been killed.
Correct, yes. There has been a shootout. We still don't know for sure whether the three have been wounded or killed.
What, Frank, would have provoked the authorities in this instance to have chosen to go for a rescue operation, whereas in the past these things have been resolved by sitting down and talking over the issues and eventually the hostages go free?
Well, I think it must be because of the political angle. There have been confusing reports all day as to exactly what the motives are, but it just finally transpired in really about the middle of the day, Yemen time, that they were Islamic militants demanding the release of their leader, and this is quite clearly something that the Yemeni government wasn't prepared to do. So in the normal instance, it's kidnappers asking for economic benefits such as roads and schools. This time, they're directly challenging the government. So the government's decided to get tough on this one, but I haven't yet had a chance to speak to the British Embassy or to the Foreign Office, but I think they're going to be hopping mad about this because this goes directly against their requests. In fact, as this shootout was probably taking place, the British ambassador was meeting with Yemen's Minister of Interior, his message being, we want a peaceful negotiation.
And very briefly, Frank, this will also have been a risky venture on the part of the authorities because it will hit the tourist trade, and that's a vital source of income.
Well, yes, I think they probably factored that in already, that that already they were going to be losing out on that score. I mean, the income they got last year was close to $100 million with every single kidnap. Of course, that is going into jeopardy, but I think the fact that, you know, their relatively clean record, as it were, of safely released hostages has now been broken, if this is confirmed, then yes, you're right. I think it's going to deter all but the most adventurous and the most foolhardy from going off the beaten track in Yemen.
Frank Gardner, live from the Gulf region. Thanks very much for joining us. In Northern Ireland, the political landscape has changed profoundly over the past year, but the tension between Catholics and Protestants lingers on in a few pockets of the province. Last night, a mother and her three children narrowly escaped injury when a small bomb exploded outside their home in Armagh. And around the town of Portadown, the tension has persisted throughout the dramatic changes at a political level which have accompanied the peace process. Our correspondent Tim Franks has spent much of the year in Northern Ireland, and in the second of his series of reports, he looks at how far the people are still divided.
The cold grey stone of Drumcree Parish Church on the edge of Portadown is only about 50 kilometres away from where the multi-party agreement was signed in April. But whereas that agreement changed the future of Northern Ireland, Drumcree has been a painful echo of the past. It's been the focus, as it has been for the previous 3 years, of the most intense sectarian tension. Protestant has been pitted implacably against Roman Catholic since the height of the religious marching season in July. Yes, the politicians moved in 1998, but here at least the people are as divided as ever.
On the road! Firing! Quick! March!
To cheers and music on the first Sunday in July, the 1,000-plus members of the Portadown Orange Lodge set off from the centre of the Protestant-dominated town of Portadown. Their annual parade, like hundreds of others across Northern Ireland, marks the anniversary of a victory for Protestants in a battle against Roman Catholics in Ireland 300 years ago. The Orangemen were marching a route which, more or less, they've gone down since 1807. The first half of the circular route brought them round to Drumcree Parish Church on the outskirts of the town. But the return leg would have taken them past what are now Roman Catholic homes. The Catholic residents along the Gavaki Road objected, saying this was sectarian triumphalism. The Protestant marchers said they were merely upholding tradition. In 1997, as in 1996, the parade had gone through only after Catholic residents had been forcibly removed from the Gavaki Road. Each time, violence ripped through the whole of Northern Ireland. In 1998, the authorities decided that on this occasion, the march would have to go down a different route. In its biggest ever operation in the province, the British Army blocked the way from Drumcree Church. The marchers swore they'd stay for as long as it took to complete their parade.
195, huh?
Anne Hatton is a Roman Catholic who lives on the Gavaki Road. She says the annual parade is intimidating for her and for all her family. Earlier this year, she sent her grandchildren away from Portadown when she thought the march would go ahead. Even now, with the parade kept back from her road, she says it's as if she's living under curfew.
I thought the idea would be to march in your own area, where your own people can see you, where you're not causing offence to anyone. I certainly wouldn't want to go and march in another, we'll say, Brownstown or Kilkenny, because I know the people would be offended. I wouldn't do it. I should be entitled to the same courtesy.
There was little of that courtesy in the middle of July. Unlike previous years, the authorities decreed that come what may, the march would not be allowed through. The decision may have been different, the effect was the same. Northern Ireland erupted. The sound of fireworks being thrown at police lines on the hill at Drumcree. In 1 week, the security forces counted 2,000 acts of civil disorder across the province. Riots flared, roads were cut in two by burning barricades. Local traffic reports turned into extended bulletins.
A number of roads are affected by the Drumcree protests. In Belfast, the junction of Newton Street and Roden Street is still blocked, while down Boyne Park is closed at the Springfield Road, and Donegal Pass and Donegal Road are both passable with care. Meanwhile, a number of traffic lights are out of action.
The city centre of Belfast emptied of cars in the evenings as people rushed home, afraid to be caught out at night. Shops and restaurants closed. People noticed the same cold feeling. The fear had returned to Northern Ireland. For some, the fear became reality. Sonia is one of those. In that single week since the march was blocked, she became one out of the 90 who were forced from their homes. Her crime? To have a different religion to her neighbours, to be a Protestant who lived just around the corner from the Gavaki Road. The protests around the march in 1997 were, she says, bad enough. In 1998, they became unbearable.
You'd hear the roaring outside. You'd know there was a load of them outside. And then you'd hear the shouting, put the windows in and calling me names. I won't repeat what it was. And I would just have to get onto the phone for the police. At one stage, there were at least 20 of them outside where the police had to come and take them away. I had visitors come to the door and they were stoned at my door. And then they said they were going to petrol bomb me.
It seemed that the violence could only escalate. There was talk of 100,000 Protestant marchers converging on Drumcree the following Monday, 8 days after the march had begun. In the event, three small boys stopped them. Richard, Mark and Jason Quinn died after a petrol bomb was thrown into their house. They happened to be Catholics living in a Protestant housing estate in the town of Ballymoney. The new and terrible day prompted some Protestant politicians to join the call for the march to be abandoned. Most striking was the alliance between David Trimble, the newly appointed First Minister of Northern Ireland, and himself a member of the Protestant Orange Order, and Seamus Mallon, the Catholic Deputy First Minister. In 1995, Mr. Trimble had been triumphant when the march had gone through against the wishes of local residents. Now, his message was different.
And I must say to the Portadown brethren that the only way in which they can clearly distance themselves from these murders is now to leave the hill at Drumcree Parish Church.
David Oliver disagreed. He, along with the other ordinary members of the Portadown Orange Order, insisted that the march must be completed down the Gavachie Road.
And see you later. And give Daddy a kiss.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
A regular part of his weekly routine now is to say goodnight to his family, leave his house, and join an all-night vigil at the church, a vigil which has been continuing every day since the 5th of July. To give up now, he says, would be to wreck hundreds of years of tradition.
This is my civil liberty. It is a major thoroughfare, main road, into Portadown. It is the route that has been used for over 300 years. The year actually feels uncompleted for the Protestants in this town.
Portadown is still a badly divided town. Violence has continued here since July. In September, a policeman died after a blast bomb was thrown at him. There appears to be no appetite for reconciliation. This stretch of tarmac, the Gavachie Road, is still a painful reminder of Northern Ireland's capacity for trauma.
Tim Franks, and tomorrow he'll be looking at the activities of paramilitaries in Northern Ireland over the past year. It's 13:46 GMT. Still to come, today's sports news, and from Australia, the shame of quokka soccer. You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. A reminder of the main news today. There have been conflicting reports following an operation to release 16 foreign tourists kidnapped yesterday in Yemen. The government says three of the hostages have been killed during a gun battle with security forces. Other reports suggest that none of the hostages has died. The British Embassy in Yemen told us just a moment ago that they could offer no clarification either way at this stage. Now today we mark the retirement of a BBC World Service stalwart. After 25 years as our economics correspondent, James Morgan is opting for the quieter life. James has seen it all. The oil crisis in the 1970s, Thatcherism and Reaganomics in the 80s, and wild stock market fluctuations in the 90s. So what has he and what have we learned during all that time? I've been looking back over the past 25 years of economics reporting with James and with Alison Cottrell, senior economist with the American bank Payne Webber. First, what are the stories that were at the top of the young James Morgan's agenda all those years ago?
Well, it's almost to the day, I suppose, or very nearly that, that the oil price started shooting up. It went up, it trebled, quadrupled, I can't remember, in late 1973, and then in 1974 it went up again, and in Britain there were particularly awful effects. There was a three-day week, the government fell, and there seemed to be sort of mayhem, and we had this word stagflation, which was coined, stagnation and inflation altogether. Economies weren't growing, even declining, and inflation in a country like Britain reached 25%, something like that, and it really did seem to be, in a sense, the end of the world.
So, Alison Cottrell, looking at the past 25 years, there have been all sorts of developments in terms of the history of global economics. But what are the principal ones? I mean, how do we get away from that situation? When we were talking about stagflation 25 years ago, how is it that we now have seemingly a relatively more stable environment?
What changed 25 years ago? We'd had a post-war period where it was almost as if you could manage inflation. You could treat it like an animal, a pet, in a sense. What happened then with the oil shock? Suddenly we embarked on this 25-year period from there where suddenly the inflation rate turned. The domestic animal stopped being a nice little baby Vietnamese pot-bellied pig, if you like, and suddenly grew up into this ravenous beast. And policy, economic policy for the past 25 years has hence been concentrated on controlling inflation. It's been driven by the fear of inflation. If you look at where we got to at the end of this 25-year stretch post-oil shock, we have, say, in Europe, the emergence of a European Central Bank whose entire constitution structure is driven at fighting inflation. Now, where we are now, today, going into 99, suddenly we're in a period where actually inflation isn't the problem anymore. So we've sort of come out of this phase, but it's not as if we're back before the last 25-year period, because we now have this consciousness that actually inflation can be a problem, and hence there's this huge policy vacuum. What do you do?
And yet, James, if we talk about having or trying to tame the beast of inflation, it seems to me that one of the marked trends of the past 25 years has been deregulation, privatization, governments getting out of economic control to a certain extent, which would almost sort of argue against the idea that they are trying to control inflation.
Well, in a sense, that might be right, but of course, they used one weapon to control inflation, and that was monetary policy, and you didn't need to do anything else. And if you had this club with which you could knock inflation on the head, you used it, and you used it as often as you could. And as Alison says, suddenly, of course, the beast was in fact tamed, and we are now facing a situation which we haven't faced since the Second World War, which is of deflation. And we've seen one country already fall into this deflationary trap, that is to say Japan, and at the moment we don't seem to have the weapons to deal with this reverse beast, as it were, the new thing that's creeping out of the jungle that's going to attack us all. And even here in Britain, which has a relatively high rate of inflation, we've suddenly seen figures which show that prices are falling, and nobody alive today, or very few people who are alive today, can remember an era when prices were falling. And however awful rising prices might seem, falling prices in many ways can be far worse.
Why?
Because nobody is ever going to do anything to get out of it, because nobody's going to spend money, nobody's going to borrow money, because everything's going to be cheaper next year. And there is very little you can do about it from the point of view of being a government. You cannot cut interest rates to below zero unless you do something very funny indeed and start giving money away or something like that.
Alison, we haven't mentioned yet that over the past 25 years, one of the major historical changes has been the end of the Cold War, the collapse of communism, the disappearance of an entire block and way of looking at the world. What impact has that had on the global economy?
Clearly, huge opportunities emerged when the wall fell, and also the emerging markets in general began to, should we say, emerge, and then of course crept back again over the last 18 months of the financial crisis. The problem is that a lot of the policy parameters were laid down at a time, well, should we say, when Yugoslavia was still united and Germany wasn't, and there's still a rethink going on as to how you now lay down the policy guidelines for what is a larger developed world. The framework, the parameters for businesses are now much more expanded than before. And to use the buzzword, a globalizing world. Things move a lot faster. It's a lot more competitive. If you look at the areas where the changes have been greatest, in other words, in Europe, we now have the single currency, of course, coming along. And the main thing which the euro will drag behind it is competition. And that's not something which all the governments joining it actually realize is a part of the package. But the competition will be much stronger. Businesses will have to become more aggressive. Inevitably, some regions will suffer in terms of rationalization and employment. There's a whole wave of structural change about to come. So in a sense, the next 25 years will be as different from the past 25 as those were from the previous 25.
And that, James, must be one of the most striking things that you will have noticed in your time doing this job, and that is that the fundamentals of economics remain the same, supply and demand and commodity prices and currency values, relatives and so forth, like those things stay the same. But the speed at which things can be done, transactions can be made, money can move now, is almost beyond recognition.
That's right, and it's led to this peculiar non-linear dynamic events, as you if you like. The fact is that things grow exponentially. You can have a crisis in Russia, a small economy today, which actually brings down other economies and causes worldwide disruptions on a scale that one can hardly begin to appreciate. And it seemed that the world was almost going to collapse just as a result of the collapse of the Russian ruble, which was patently absurd. The world didn't. But what we do know from the last 25 years is that there are certain right ways of doing things, but they don't necessarily remain right forever unless they are carefully honed and looked after and sharpened, and that you have to be vigilant the whole time. Nothing works forever.
James Morgan, who will not be working forever. We wish him well in his retirement. I was also speaking to Alison Cottrell of Payne Webber. Sports news now. Here's Joe Parsons.
Thank you. The winning skipper in the Sydney to Hobart yacht race, Larry Ellison, has criticised race officials, saying the storm-ravaged race should not have gone ahead. Four yachtsmen have been confirmed dead and two others are missing, presumed drowned. Ellison, first across the line on Sayonara, says the conditions were among the worst he'd experienced.
Things got extremely dangerous, holding the boat together and holding themselves together.
I mean, guys were knocked down time and time again and kept getting up and kept getting back to work and kept doing what needed to be done to keep the boat in one piece and keep all of us alive. It was a truly extraordinary experience for all of us. Our condolences go out to the families who lost people who were in this race, sailors who were in this race, and our prayers go out to the search crews and the people who are still in the water. We hope they all can be found.
South Africa's cricketers have taken an unassailable 3-0 lead in the Test series over West Indies. South Africa, needing 146 to win the third Test in Durban, reached their target for the loss of just one wicket on the fourth day. Earlier, they dismissed the tourists for 259. And England's cricketers are celebrating their first Test victory on the current tour of Australia. After bowling England out for 244 in their second innings in the fourth Test in Melbourne, the Australians needed 175 to take a 3-0 lead in the series. But thanks to a stunning performance from Dean Headley, who took 6 for 60, they were dismissed for 162, 13 runs short of their target. And Hong Kong's top anti-corruption agency has charged a police sergeant and seven others with fixing football matches. It's also alleged the police officer offered bribes to other police staff for information about raids on bookmaking centres. And that's the sport.
Thanks, Joe. The authorities in Western Australia have promised to clamp down on a brutal game which involves kicking a particular species of wild animal to death. The quokka is a gentle and trusting creature whose only response to danger is to roll into a small ball, making it easy prey for a barbaric practice known as quokka soccer. From Australia, David Grossman reports.
The quokkas live on Rottnest Island near Fremantle off the mouth of the Swan River in Western Australia. Early Dutch explorers mistook them for rats and so called their home Rottnest or Rat's Nest Island. They're not, of course, rats, but a small cousin of the kangaroo. Every Australian summer, the quokkas have to share their island with an invasion force with one objective in mind.
You party.
You smoke some more, you drink. Evolution hasn't equipped the quokkas to deal with this menace. Instead of running, they simply roll up and wait for trouble to pass, leaving themselves vulnerable to a barbarous game known as quokka soccer. Supervising Wildlife Officer Doug Cochran says the practice has been around for years.
Just this hangover from the bad old days when people would go through high school and university and think that it's a joke to go out and kick a defenseless animal to death and quite frankly think it was a rite of passage. Well, it's not. It's unacceptable and it's barbaric.
One particularly bloody day earlier this month, nine quokkas were kicked to death, prompting police and wildlife authorities into action. The quokkas already enjoy protection under conservation legislation. It was just a matter of enforcing the law. Dozens of officers were dispatched to Rottnest to try to gather enough evidence to get a conviction. In the past, it's been difficult to prosecute anyone because witnesses are reluctant to testify. But this year, one 18-year-old was stupid enough to kill a quokka right in front of a policeman. A youth was arrested and faces a hefty fine if convicted, about $6,000.
The person that we have caught for doing the one that caused all the excitement, he should deserve to cop the penalty that goes along with it. You just don't come around on the island and kicking quokkas.
As a result of the case, the unfortunate quokkas have become a political football as well. In the Western Australian Parliament, the government's faced calls for students to be banned from Rottnest. The state's Premier, Richard Court, whilst rejecting a ban for now, put the troublemakers on notice for the future.
They need to accept their responsibilities. They need to protect property. They need to protect the wildlife. And certainly we wouldn't want to see a ban on students, but we do want to see an improvement in the behaviour.
Police and wildlife officers say that rather than a ban, what's needed is a change in attitudes. But changing attitudes is a slow process. Wildlife officer Doug Cochran says some people have questioned the need for the crackdown on quokka soccer.
There has been the odd comment by adults that when they were young going through university, they did the same thing, and so why is it, you know, what's the big deal with their kids doing it? Well, the thing is, it was never acceptable and certainly not acceptable now. You know, if it takes that type of entertainment to impress so-called friends, well, you're keeping the wrong company, I would suggest.
Wildlife Officer Doug Cochran, ending that report from David Grossman. People do some extraordinary things. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. This is Max Pearson in London. Until the next time, from all of us here, thanks for listening. Goodbye.